Well, a song of the season from Brian Bates. Merry, that's M-A-R-Y. Merry Christmas. Hope for the Hopeless, that came courtesy of the group Sierra. We heard from Michael W. Smith and Awesome God. 13 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Monday morning, December the 2nd, and we're pleased to have with us today, as we do most Mondays, and we're thankful for that, Dr. Don Clark of Creation Moments. Don, a biochemist, and the only biochemist you will hear on the air here. There's no competition for you, for Don.
Well, that's just great. I don't know. Maybe there should be some competition. That way we could do a little bit more research.
Actually, we've had other scientists on, and you brought them here. We've had some fascinating discussions, and I should mention to everybody that you can listen to past discussions with Dr. Don on the website under what we're now calling the podcast archives, and go up there and download a podcast from any time the last couple of years, weekly conversations, and they last 30, 35 minutes, and typically very interesting. And you can learn a lot from those podcasts, and we've got a lot of traffic to that part of the website. So, Don, I'm. We talked about superbugs last week. We talked about the end of the age of antibiotics. The medical industry, in particular, is concerned that soon they'll find that they have nothing effective against diseases or infections because of the development of superbugs. That is, bacteria that grows resistant to existing antibiotics, and that the industry itself, the pharmaceutical industry, doesn't see the value. There aren't the dollars there to justify new research on this for new kinds of antibiotics. Where is this all headed? Are there other ways to fight infections other than antibiotics?
Well, there are, and they're usually the old methods
we'll have to go back to.
Mm-hmm. And I think as far as topical treatments, if you get a cut, for example, on your finger or your hand or anywhere else, instead of jumping for the antibiotic cream, you can use just straight hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide is a wonderful antimicrobial. It not only kills bacteria, but it also kills fungus. Mm-hmm. Probably does a nice job with viruses as well. So
I've heard of people using that as a disinfectant even around the kitchen. You can spray cutting boards and sinks and stuff with the correct proportion of hydrogen peroxide. It has to be diluted.
You can use the bottles that you pick up from your grocery store or your drugstore. You can mm-hmm. use that straight on your cuts, but if you're going to be spraying down, let's say your bathroom, shower, or your countertops, you probably want to dilute that. And the proper dilution's usually 2 ounces, 2 ounces of the hydrogen peroxide you get from the store in a gallon of water. So it's fairly dilute.
Okay, now you're talking about those dark brown bottles that are meant for first aid.
Yes,
there's also food grade hydrogen peroxide, which I think is a lot stronger, and you have to cut it with water.
Right, but to get the microbial activity, you can use just the straight the brown bottles. Mm-hmm. Those are, I believe, about 3% hydrogen peroxide. So when you cut it down to 2 ounces to a gallon of water, you're cutting the concentration back, quite a bit. And that's perfectly, adequate for, like I said, spraying your bathroom or mm-hmm. spraying your countertops or spraying your cutting boards.
So how does hydrogen peroxide kill bacteria then? Because it must be, in a way, different from antibiotics.
Well, it's a free radical generator, and it basically oxidizes.
It burns them up.
It burns them up. Uh-huh. It literally burns them up. Yes. So that's why it's nonspecific. So it doesn't care what the organic matter is. It will literally burn it up. And when you put it on your skin, for example, and put it on a cut, yes, it is burning up some of the cells that are around, the cut area. But it's also, more importantly, killing the bugs that might have migrated into the cut at the time of the cut. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly more beneficial to kill all the bugs away so that you don't, you have a pretty much a sterile area, to deal with. Then you can put gauze and stuff, over that, mm-hmm. Just like you would with a normal cut. So it's a great product to use. There are some commercial available sprays, especially for your bathroom and stuff, that are hydrogen peroxide generators, and pretty much do the same thing. But it's real cheap just to go ahead and excuse me, get a bottle and use it. You know, use it for multiple purposes. Mm-hmm. Around the kitchen and around the bathroom and wherever else you want to sanitize.
Well, what makes it inferior then to antibiotics? Is it
well, you can't take it. You can't drink it internally. That's part of the problem. Mm. So if you've got a systemic infection, then you wouldn't want to drink hydrogen peroxide because it will attack the lining of your intestinal system and your stomach. But there is another product that you can easily generate and make, and that's colloidal silver. And this product has been around for a long time. And there, if you search the internet, you can find colloidal silver generators that basically convert metal silver into tiny particles that they remain suspended in solution. So the word colloid, for example, is just a suspension of particles. Mm-hmm. If the particles are too big, they settle out. And so this colloidal generator actually generates, breaks up the silver particles so that they're, suspended in water.
So it in essence, dissolves silver.
It's not a solution of silver.
Okay.
It's not a silver ion.
A compound.
It is actually the metal silver, mm-hmm. but it is very tiny particles that remain in suspension.
And how does that act on an infection then?
Well, it acts very well on the infections. The silver actually binds to proteins and various components of the bacteria, let's say, mm-hmm. or the virus. It is again a broad spectrum microbial, so it is effective against viruses, and antibiotics are totally not effective against viruses. And so you have an antimicrobial. You can use it like you would hydrogen peroxide topically. You can use it on your countertops and stuff like that, but I would use hydrogen peroxide for
is
that.
Is it expensive, colloidal silver?
Is it what?
Expensive?
It's not very expensive to make.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I've ever seen it available for sale. Would you go to a pharmacy for that?
Well, it doesn't last a long time in the colloidal state. That's the problem. You might find it in a health food store in small bottles, but these colloidal silver generators are relatively inexpensive, and you can just make a batch at home. Periodically, mm-hmm. and keep it in a dark, keep your solution or suspension in a dark, dark place until you're ready to use it.
How would you make it?
It's an electrolysis process,
okay.
And so you're buying like a little electrolysis machine that generates the colloidal silver.
Do you have to find silver though to add to it? Do you have to have pure silver?
Yes, and I believe usually the companies that are selling these colloidal silver generators will, supply you with the silver that you need.
You can't just drop a quarter in it then and get colloidal silver. Of course, there's probably no silver in a quarter.
Well, if it was probably a silver quarter, yeah. try to find one of those.
Now, I remember some other treatments for superficial wounds from years past, like iodine. Like mercurochrome, what are those substances? How do they act on bacteria? The same thing? Do they oxidize it? Burn it?
Well, it burns it. I mean, it's the tincture of iodine, for example, that you used to see in these little glass vials with the glass rod.
Yeah,
and then you would put that over your wound. That was very effective. It also killed the tissue around it, but it was extremely effective, and. It would still be a good alternative to use for cuts and scrapes. very much like, you know, you would use hydrogen peroxide.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of alternatives out there than just, you know, reaching for the antibiotic cream or, you know, these hand sanitizers, for example, antibiotic hand sanitizers, where you're wiping your hands down with antibiotics. You know, I would stay away from anything like that.
Anything that says antibacterial, then, would mean antibiotics.
Yeah, there's an antibiotic in it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And with the silver, though, you can actually drink that, and it can, you know, it can treat a systemic infection.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been studies that have shown that it's effective by itself, or it actually enhances the effectiveness against, you know, these superbugs of regular antibiotics. So you could use it in conjunction with a normal antibiotic and make sure that you're killing all of the you know, the bacteria that you want to kill with their standard antibiotics.
So in terms of medical practitioners, then, there are alternatives to antibiotics. And so why the concern, unless there's a big difference in price or availability?
No.
Or is it just a matter of this is the way we've done things?
This is the way we've done things.
Okay.
This is what we've been taught, and we haven't been taught the old procedures, mm-hmm. which is kind of crazy. I don't understand why they aren't using something like hydrogen peroxide, for example, in hospitals to spray down surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just makes a whole lot of sense, you know, to do that.
What's used now?
They're using antibiotics. They're using products that, you know, don't kill over periods of time, just don't kill all the bugs. And so, you know, even things like isopropyl alcohol. I mean, we used to use, some of us still use isopropyl alcohol to clean clean wounds and stuff like that, too. These are, you know, simple chemicals that have aseptic, you know, properties to them. And we really need to, you know, be thinking about going back to them and, you know, doing the research. And then they're very simple. Alcohol is very simple to use. And it's, you know, it's relatively, harmless as well as, you know, hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide, you got to keep it away from your clothes because it will bleach, you know, it will bleach your clothes. You know, other than that, it's a great product. It's got all kinds of uses.
It sounds to me like, once again, this boils down to dollars. Somebody is selling something. There's an industry behind it that pushes a certain solution, a certain product, or a range of products, and the medical profession is bought into it and isn't looking elsewhere.
Well, and that's right. And you're not going to find this. You're not going to find hydrogen peroxide marketed. You know, for the multiple uses. Now, if I made hydrogen peroxide and was selling it on the market, I would probably promote it as much as possible. But medical uses, you see, are under the control of the FDA. And if you're going to have a medical claim, then you need to go through the clinical studies and file your application with the FDA to get a medical claim put on your product. So I can see these, you know, the manufacturers of these more simpler solutions not wanting to go through the expense of that. So it really boils down to, you know, sharing this information over Facebook or, you know, radio programs like this. And, you know, people can then, there's all kinds of research and studies that have been done that you can find on the internet on both colloidal silver and hydrogen peroxide.
How old is... I'm sorry, go ahead, David.
Yeah, was there a period of time where one was no longer used in topical situations like hospitals and doctor's offices and they started to use antibiotic materials instead?
Well, I'm sure there was a period of time when that became popular, when antibiotics, you know, really took off. Probably, I would say, probably maybe even as early as the 70s or, you know, maybe even earlier than that, where we had these wonder drugs that was, you know, killing all kinds of bacteria. And so they said, well, you know, might as well make it into a topical and just spray the hospital equipment down with it, you know, to sanitize. Mm-hmm. And initially, that was a great idea. But the problem is now we've got these superbugs that are resistant to these products, and we need to go back to a little bit more kind of a basic approach.
But apparently the superbugs would still be susceptible to products like hydrogen peroxide. It would still do away with them.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What? As well as fungus. Now, you know, mm-hmm. Fungus, there's a whole different class of compounds, chemicals that are used as antifungals. Those are totally different than the antibiotics. And, you know, overuse of antifungals will lead to fungus that is resistant to the antifungals. But here again, hydrogen peroxide burns the fungus, and you know, you don't have that problem.
Hmm. Hmm. Just in time for the Christmas season, Amazon has a Life Force is the brand name. It's a compact colloidal silver generating package.
Hey,
oh well, there you go.
$79.
Yeah, plus, so they're not.
Yeah, they're not incredibly expensive. And I see on the page here, there's all kinds of other packages like it, from $50 to $350, and then also pure silver wire.
Uh-huh.
You know, 10-gauge pure silver wire, 6 inches long, two of them for $38.
Yeah. Okay. So, and you can make tremendous quantities of colloidal silver. Like I said, it doesn't it doesn't last forever. And you got to keep it away, you know, from light. But it's a very effective alternative to.
And that's internal or externally.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yes. Yeah. The colloidal silver will work internally, which of course the hydrogen peroxide doesn't.
Did that come from folk medicine, or is that a technologically developed product? I mean, electrolysis. I'm not sure how many old farmers and cavemen knew about electrolysis. Where did colloidal silver start? Do you know?
It has been around for years. I can remember hearing about it probably 30, 40 years ago.
Okay. So it's newer than what you would call folk medicine then. It's not part of folk medicine.
It's not part of folk medicine. It's just not part of mainstream, you know, mm-hmm. medicine.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's kind of that... I don't know what you would call it, but do-it-yourself type of, mm-hmm. okay. you know, medicine mm-hmm. Part. Here's what your grandmother used to do. But it's a little bit more sophisticated, you know, than that, because it's obviously you got to generate the colloidal silver.
Mm-hmm. Hippocrates used silver for treating.
Who did? Socrates?
Hippocrates.
Oh, okay, back on. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the caduceus guy. Mm-hmm. He'd been treating diseases for back as far as 4000 BC. Eastern Persian records specifically mention the practice of placing water in silver. And then the ancient Babylonian and Greek civilizations were aware of silver's ability to disinfect.
Huh. Hmm. Interesting. Who knew? Yeah.
So it's been around for a long time.
Wow.
Now, the interesting thing is, if you made medical instruments that were silver plated, they would have this antimicrobial activity as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So surfaces made out of the stuff will also, you know, be antimicrobial.
Weren't they at one time?
I think they were.
It seems like that at one time. You know, old doctors' instruments were valuable because they were silver coated,
right? Yeah, silver plated.
Or silver plated.
So
yeah.
Now, you know, now of course we use stainless steel, and we use stainless steel in mm-hmm. in a lot of medicine as well as food production. But if we coat them with silver, then we would be in better shape with probably keeping things a little more. Antiseptic, if you will, or sterile.
I remember, and I'm reading this article now. It says silver nitrate used to be used in newborn children's eyes to make sure that no venereal disease was passed on.
Yes. Yeah, and, I remember that with our kids. Yeah. They would put silver nitrate drops.
Yeah, and I guess, is that still done? I don't know why not.
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't had a baby in a long time.
You'll have to find a young couple and ask that question.
I've never had one, so I have no idea. You guys are way ahead of me in that field. There's only one of me, and when I'm gone, that's it.
Well, it sounds like there are alternatives then, and they're bound to come center stage if, in fact, antibiotics are on their way out. And that new ones will not be developed.
So you got to keep, keep your ears and eyes tuned to the alternative kind of medicine type of approaches. You'd find these in those type of things. But yet, these have been proven for years after years after year. You know, it's a proven.
And it's interesting to realize how close that information is to our fingertips. I mean, David just gave us the history of colloidal silver. People are bound to find this out and see it and maybe demand that the medical profession start looking at this and quit playing games here.
Well, you remember who you're talking about now. We're talking about the American population, and they're not necessarily the smartest tool in the drawer. They elected the guy we got, and they're allowing them to stay in office, and they're not walking on the White House in this nutty Obamacare thing. And it's
how is it that whenever we talk to Dr. Don, we get back to the theory of devolution?
I think so. Seems like
I think with any of this, it's going back to taking responsibility for your own health. And not relying on the medical profession or the government to take care of you is kind of the bottom line. And so, if you hear of a problem, in this case, superbugs, go and do the research and figure out, how am I going to protect my family against these things?
Yeah, now the research is relatively easy. The only thing you got to be aware of is crack, idiots on the internet that are giving you bad information.
You've got to be selective.
Yeah. So, okay. Always interesting to talk with Dr. Don. We had considered talking about another article today, and I'm not sure what it was about. It had something to do with pigs and chimpanzees or apes and crossbreeding.
That was what they had afterwards, champagne.
They had a big party.
Oh. What was all that about, Don?
There was a genetics researcher who is proposing that the origins of man came from a pig having sex with a chimpanzee.
Okay.
He'd gone to a movie first, I think, wasn't
it? Yes. He wrote a hypothetical paper on the subject and said this is how it could possibly happen. Now his whole paper, he had admits that the DNA, for example, for a pig is not going to match up with the DNA of a chimpanzee.
Right.
That there's not going to be much overlap. So, for example, when we mate, we have one strand of DNA comes from the father, and one strand of DNA comes from the mother. And every chromosome, we have 23 chromosomes, and 22 out of the 23 chromosomes, the DNA pair up, and you get your double helix, which is, your diploid chromosome, pair. The only one that doesn't pair up completely is the XY chromosome, because the Y chromosome is a lot shorter than the X chromosome. So you got some DNA that's kind of hanging free there. But, he's suggesting that when you take, for example, I would call them kinds in this case, interspecies or interkinds, then the DNA doesn't match up. Or at least not completely, and you got spots where the DNA may match up. And he's suggesting that these flappy DNA then can cross the DNA, for example, the DNA of a pig would then cross over to the to the DNA of the chimp, of the ape, and that would then ultimately get incorporated into the chimp DNA. And if, let's carry the story a little bit further, the pig, there was a male pig that mated with a female chimpanzee, then the chimpanzee would more likely be with her own tribe. And so you would get more ape, DNA, because an ape would probably mate with the offspring, for example, and then the offspring would. So you would. This is how you can incorporate foreign DNA, if you will, into the chimpanzee. Totally, it's, you know, just a thought process. There's no experiments to show that this is even, you know, possible. Something, you know, this complex would never happen in nature, and then the offspring would never survive. I mean, we have problems, for example, with Down syndrome, and Down syndrome is only an extra chromosome in your DNA, in the nucleus of your cell, and it causes all kinds of problems for the individual. So to have a mixture, a tremendous mixture of two kinds of animals like this is, in practical terms, you know, ludicrous. Mm-hmm. Now, if we look at it from the biblical standpoint and go back to Genesis, of course, we learned that God said, let them be fruitful and multiply after their kind. So God placed in our DNA, in our, biological systems, defenses against such type of, experiments or things like this actually happening and producing progeny that would actually survive. It's just purely a thought, thought experiment.
However, Don, this could explain my predilection for fried pork chops.
Well, you don't want to eat your grandpappy there.
Well,
right. Or your fellow.
It'd be my grandpappy twice removed, at least.
Called intergenerational cannibalism.
Right. Yeah, we don't have such things as fried chimpanzee chops.
But, no.
That would predispose that we, yes, obviously that proves that we did come from chimpanzees.
Well, certainly.
In some fashion.
And, did you get down, deeper in the article, Don?
Yes,
this article.
Did.
Yeah, and down in the bottom. And one of the things that attracted my attention right away as soon as I opened up that particular page, he said this is the last page of this entire document. And then over on the right-hand side is a box, an advertising for a superb dark humor from the ivory tower. It's a book called The Department, written by the author. And if you get way, way down below in the article, it says, click here to buy my book. And the one of the main creatures in the book, in the department, is an F1 pig ape hybrid, and it's in satire of the academic life.
So he's poking fun at the whole process with us.
That's what it sounds like. Okay. And pig ape hybrid. So the So I guess we can imagine a large pot belly on his legs, on his hind legs, in a vest with a monocle, operating a Bunsen burner.
It could be.
I think so. Yeah, okay. I think that's what we're talking about.
Well, I'm somewhat relieved to think that perhaps this was done in jest.
Well, that's what it looks like.
Or at least a little sarcasm. Yeah.
And maybe perhaps the satire was initially not thought to be realistic, and then somebody says, say, could that really happen?
Yeah, there's something to this. Yeah.
It was written in, in terms like, wow, this is really a scientific article, because, of course, he's using all kinds of scientific jargon and crossover, DNA and you know, back crosses and everything when you get more of your, for example, the second generation of this hybrid crossing with more chimps. You know, and he's certainly making it sound like, well, this is a plausible thing that could happen, but obviously it's all totally ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, and he's, you know, later on in the article, he talks about the hybridization between gorillas and chimpanzees, but they're a really, very close related species. I mean, they're total strangers.
And this is the problem with nomenclature. You have to differentiate between the differences in kind and the differences in a species. Mm-hmm. Two different species may be two different kinds, but at the same time, two different species, for example, you've got the dog and the wolf, which are probably the same kind. And it was, you know, a dog at one point in time that went wild and, you know, became a wolf. Or a fox, for example, you know, it's easy to see. And the general test to see if this you know, animal is a potential member of the same kind is to breed them. And if they do happen to breed and produce a progeny that actually survive, then you might have the same kind.
Yeah, survive and reproduce themselves then.
Yeah.
Because that would also be
now,
nasty.
If they don't, for example, let's take the rabbit. There is a southern rabbit that will breed with, you know, kind of the middle states rabbit, but it won't breed with the northern rabbit. But
really?
The northern rabbit will breed with the central rabbit. And so obviously all of them are members of the same kind, but in this case, the northern rabbit, you know, just won't breed with the southern rabbit because there's been too much DNA modification we lose genes over, you know, over a period of time, you know, as well. So, you can have a different number of chromosomes even happening between you know, different species, but within the same kind. And so there's multiple reasons why two species that are in the same kind family, if you will, you know, don't happen to breed. So the test that can you breed these two and are they of the same kind doesn't necessarily work all the time.
Okay. Interesting stuff. And it gets more complicated all the time. I think I'll just stick to radio. I think I'll do that. Press a button, things happen. You know,
it's why we're in radio.
I think so.
But biology is so much. I mean, it's very interesting.
Well, it is interesting. That's why we're talking about it. But there's so much detail there to specialize in that. It takes a different kind of drive than I have, I think. We're talking with Dr. Don Clark again, a member of the board of Creation Moments. And I recommend you visit their website, creationmoments.com. You can link there from ours. I also recommend that you download a podcast or two and tackle some of the other subjects that we've talked about with Dr. Don over the last couple of years. I think you'll find it interesting. And it doesn't take a lot of time to do. You can be thoroughly entertained and intrigued and informed within about a half an hour on various topics. So take a peek at it under the podcast archives tab at brokenroadradio.com. Don, as always, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. And we'll look forward to next Monday.
Well, it's been another pleasurable Monday and morning, and look forward to talking with you all again.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
Take care. Yeah, bye-bye.